This is episode 29 of the Software Freedom Law Show for Tuesday, June 8th, 2010. Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Cohn.
And I'm Aaron Williamson.
And this is the Software Freedom Law Show. Thanks for joining us again. And we've got Aaron, who's our sometimes co-host.
Yes. Maybe more lately than ever.
Is that true?
It's sort of like that thing in Hamlet.
Which thing in Hamlet?
The thing that Claudius says, that was one of Claudius's first lines. Our sometimes sister, now our queen.
I'm now your queen.
Well, it's a weird line in Hamlet, right? Because he's like introducing, he says, she's our sometimes sister, now our queen. He's using the royal we.
For our listeners, I think we may have even talked about this before, but Bradley is very familiar with the play Hamlet. I was wondering if I mentioned any other play by Shakespeare, if you would maybe react in the same way.
I don't have it memorized like
because
I have
you,
large portions of Hamlet memorized.
You often quote from Hamlet as if we would all know Hamlet.
Didn't you all memorize Hamlet when you were a freshman in college?
Well, we didn't all have a non-speaking role that was involved in every scene in the play.
Yes, that's correct. It wasn't a non-speaking role.
Sorry.
I had the first... Bernardo has the first line in Hamlet.
Did you know that Shakespeare, at least according to one history, had a son who he named Hamnet, who only lived to the young age of 8 or so?
I heard that too, yeah.
See, and I thought that Hamlet was what you called it if you cooked that character from Winnie the Pooh.
Aw, poor Piglet.
Yeah, it's actually who's there is the first line. The third line is stand and unfold yourself.
You know, it just reminds me of the one line I had, and I forget even what play it was, but I had one line which was plucking the entrails from an offering forth, they could not find a heart within the beast.
Wow.
I had 78 lines.
Yeah.
It was just, I had 78 lines at the beginning, was in every
what
scene.
But none of yours were about evisceration.
That's true. There is some evisceration in Hamlet, though.
There is.
I need to know.
Very palpable evisceration.
So why are you here, Aaron?
I guess I'm here to talk about...
We have news, but not the news that we said we might have last time. So last time,
Hold on, Karen. You need to be careful. Remember, this is coming out on Tuesday. Monday could be Bilski Day. This may come out...
Once again, we may be outdated by the time we publish.
Right. Monday could be Bilski Day.
Monday could very well be Bilski Day.
Can we get a cake for Bilski Day?
I think we should.
Yeah.
What would it be shaped like? A patent.
That would be easy. There are a lot of rectangular cakes out there.
Right. So
it could be shaped
hoping...
like a business method.
Boy. That would be difficult.
Yeah. I don't know how that works.
Yeah.
Could we infringe a patent with a cake? Could we find some patent?
Oh, I'm sure.
Right, so we should read up on some business method for creating cakes and make sure that the cake is
you're
made
really
in that
preparing
way.
To willfully infringe here, aren't you?
I was thinking of willfully infringing. I was just going to make and use. I wasn't going to sell.
Hmm. You know, cake is a lie. Never mind. So, it was Julius Caesar.
The entrails.
The entrails were from Julius Caesar.
I know parts of Julius Caesar by heart, but not most of it.
Oh, but you didn't recognize that line.
No, I didn't.
So the big news we don't have is that Bilski came down. We don't have that news because it didn't.
But it may have by the time you listen to this, in which case...
I forgot we're in the future.
Well, we're not in the future.
Oh, wait. When will then be now?
Then will be now on Tuesday, and then it'll be then.
Okay.
But that's okay, because we're planning... We'll need 2 weeks to get together a story about Bilski.
Cutting Guide for Layered Cake, U.S. Patent 3987541, a guide for cutting a cake into multiple layers.
Wow.
Okay, we'll be sure to infringe that.
I'm sure that this patent makes a cake sound... worse than a cake ever sounded.
I think that's probably true. So we're not going to talk about Bilski, whether or not it's been decided by the time you listen to this, but we have other news that is news for us today, which is a little bit older by the time this is published.
Right.
But still less than a week.
Sure. which is that we recently filed a motion in our case before the Southern District of New York. I'm sure that many of our listeners will recall that there was a, that there is ongoing litigation regarding BusyBox. It's a matter with initially, I believe, 14 defendants, some of whom have been dismissed as a result of settlements with individual defendants, but many defendants are still in the case. And we filed a motion for summary judgment and default judgment against the defendant Westinghouse.
So just one defendant?
Just one defendant out of the many in the case.
And it doesn't affect... I mean, it's just relevant for that one defendant.
Yes.
It's not like this is a... this is a motion that will resolve the entire case against all defendants.
Right.
So why did we file for both, Aaron?
Well, so we initially asked the court permission to file a motion for summary judgment, which we considered appropriate because we were at a point in the litigation with that defendant where we had filed our complaint, of course, and they had filed an answer. And typically you file a motion for default judgment when a defendant doesn't answer the complaint.
But before we go any further, what's it mean to answer a complaint?
To answer is merely to file a reply to the complaint. Typically, you know, your answer will consist of a bunch of denials of the of all of the claims in the complaint.
And but, to back up a little bit further, we should probably say what a complaint is. I know people who are listening, you know, have we've talked about our complaints before, but whenever I
talk about my complaints all the time.
I always think it's like, oi, my back hurts. You know, which is a little bit of a different kind of complaint.
Do you want me to complain about proprietary software?
Well,
I have a complaint about
In fact, that's sort of what we were doing before the court.
That's a really good point.
We were complaining about proprietary software.
But it's more formal than that. It's not just me saying that the proprietary software is bad for users.
Yes, if you just went into the court and started complaining, they might not be too inclined to listen. So we filed a complaint.
It's a formal complaint.
Yes, it is a legal document that is the document that initiates a lawsuit. And that complaint alleged essentially that it alleged very similar facts regarding all of these defendants, which is that each of them is producing and distributing a consumer electronics device. I believe they're all consumer electronics devices. Each of which contained BusyBox in the firmware, and none of which included the source code or an offer for source code with the product that was shipping BusyBox. So that was our complaint, and you can, I am sure, read it online. Did we post this one on our website?
I think we did. I'll check.
But it's very similar to many other complaints that we filed. And this particular defendant, though many defendants filed, this particular defendant filed an answer, as did, I believe, all of the defendants in the case. However, the defendant did not file anything after that reply and has not participated in the case since filing that answer. So we considered a motion for summary judgment more appropriate than a motion for default judgment, because summary judgment essentially says we've given the court enough facts with which to make a finding for us that there are no issues of law in dispute in the case, or there's no reasonable dispute, and that therefore the court should find for us. And the reason that's true is that they have not participated in the case.
And you actually showed up in person to ask for this, right?
Yeah, so we asked the court for permission, and the way that this particular judge does things is that she requires the parties to come in for a pre-motion conference so that they can discuss, so that we can say why we're making the motion, and the defendant could show up to say why the judge should not allow the motion to be made at all. And this is entirely before the motion is actually filed and decided upon.
And to clarify something for our listeners, because they may have heard of something called pre-trial motions, what you're talking about is actually a pre-trial motion conference, but it's probably just called a pre-motion conference to make it simpler, right?
Sure, yeah.
That's correct?
Yeah, so, no, that's correct.
The motions you're talking about will be what would be called pre-trial motions.
It's pre-trial motion, but this is a pre-motion conference for a pre-trial motion.
Right.
That is true. And so we went in to ask the judge permission because that's how things are done. And
with this judge, that's just her procedure.
Right.
Yeah, each judge has their own procedures, and usually many of them are available and maintained by their clerks.
Right. So the judge in this case is Judge Shira Shindlin of the 2nd District of New York. There is, by the way, a false rumor circulating that Judge Shindlin is the sister of Judge Judy, the People's Court judge from TV.
Oh, they have the same last name or something?
They have the same last name, except that they're spelled differently. So the rumor is not true. I don't want to perpetuate it, but I thought that would be interesting for our listeners.
We know, to be clear, we know of no one related to Judge Judy at all. And no one we have mentioned ever, to our knowledge, is related to Judge Judy in any way.
None of the characters appearing in this podcast should be considered. Or they're all fictional. And if they bear any
especially
resemblance
us.
To...
I really, really hope that's true. That's a big benefit to me if that's true.
So, anyway, we went in for this conference because we had to ask permission to file a motion.
Did the defendant turn up?
No. I feel like we've been retaining a little bit of mystery about this. Westinghouse has not shown up or has not participated in the case since their answer, because they essentially, at least they have said, they ran out of money. They filed for some California common law status similar to bankruptcy.
That's their claim, anyway.
Right. And they so we've seen some documents related to this, and... essentially, they wound up, the corporation sold off most of the assets to some sort of clearinghouse, which then sold them to some other company.
That's also named Westinghouse.
Which then changed its name to Westinghouse. So, so essentially, Westinghouse didn't show up, possibly because they couldn't afford their lawyers, or at least that's sort of the claim that they're making. So they didn't show up at this pre-motion conference. Sort of funny story, a couple of other defendants' attorneys did show up to the conference, presumably just to see what was going on, but they weren't required by the judge to be there.
Yeah, it's pretty sensible if there's some action in a case that you're involved with, even if that particular action doesn't concern you, you probably want to take a look and see what's going on.
Yeah, it's a good idea to see what the judge is doing with regard to other defendants, etc. So it was perfectly reasonable, but they sat at the defendant's table in the courtroom, once we were all called in there, and the judge, again, reasonably assumed that these were the defendants at issue in this motion, and sort of started tearing into them about why they hadn't participated in discovery in this case. And it took a good deal of talking to from the judge before somebody got in a word to say, Your Honor, we're not the droids you're looking for.
Also, nobody wants to interrupt the judge.
Oh, no, of course not. Yeah. Of course not. So they got a good talking to on behalf of, or in place of Westinghouse before we cleared everything up and told the judge that, in fact, these defendants were behaving as she had ordered.
I think it may have seemed longer, that whole ordeal, than because you guys were up in the front. I was in the gallery, and it was only a total of 3 minutes of confusion.
Sure.
But maybe 2.5.
But I know that had I been in the position of these defendants, would have been a little bit terrified if the judge was giving me that talking to.
But they weren't the droids.
They weren't the droids she was looking for. So Westinghouse didn't turn up, and so the judge said, okay, you have leave to file this motion, but why are you filing a motion for summary judgment and not also default judgment? Because you'd be entitled to both.
Explain to everyone what is default judgment first, and then we'll talk about what summary judgment is.
Well, default judgment is what it sounds like, that if you are in default, in other words, if you simply don't show up when a lawsuit has been initiated against you, then essentially the plaintiff wins by default. Because you haven't answered, the court has no reason to do anything but accept the word of the plaintiff, that the facts they allege in their complaint are true, and they get a finding by default. Now, it's possible to have a default judgment set aside, if you had some reasonable excuse for not showing up. And a reasonable excuse would be something like, you were never served with the complaint, because a plaintiff has a duty to serve all of the defendants with the complaint so that they have notice of the lawsuit.
If you didn't know about it, then you can't be expected to to respond.
And what does it mean to be served with a complaint? So everybody
have you not seen
that?
Serving Sarah?
I haven't. It sounds terrible.
It was terrible.
Okay. Was that a sitcom or a movie?
It was a movie. Okay. I think that's what it was
called.
I don't
think they'll make a whole sitcom about serving people with documents.
Serving one person, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Did the process server and Sarah fall in love?
Boy,
it sounds like a romantic comedy.
I can't even remember. It totally was a romantic comedy.
Yeah, I have been served before, so I know what service is.
Do we have to put a link to the IMDb for this terrible movie in the show notes now?
Probably.
I think we do. Oh, and I did check to see. We did publish the original complaint on our website, and I'll link to it in the show notes.
But some listeners might not know what being served with documents means. So what does it mean to be served with documents, and what does the plaintiff have to do that service? What is their requirement?
Well, you essentially have to deliver the document to the defendant, and you usually do this through a professional process server who will serve the defendant, essentially get a description of the circumstances of service, so the time served, the name and physical description of the person who is served, and what their position is at the company, if you're serving a company. And then they will, the process server will write up an affidavit of service, and you will then that's then an exhibit to your motion for default judgment if you end up filing one.
So clear up something, because I read this in a book once that was it was either Stephen Levy's Hackers or it was When Where Wizards Stay Up Late.
Is that any good, Hackers?
It's not a bad book. It's
better than
it's
the movie.
No, the movie Hackers has nothing. The Angelina Jolie thing has nothing to do with the book Hackers.
I know.
Actually, RMS is profiled in Stephen Levy's Hackers. But I think it was either in that book or there's another book about some of the founding people of the internet called Where Wizards Stay Up Late. I think it was one of those two books where I read that this idea that if somebody tries to serve, because, you know, there were people involved in those things that were somewhat black hat-ish, and they had this idea going around that if somebody tried to serve you with papers, all you had to do is, like, put your hands on your head and walk away and refuse to accept. That doesn't work, does it?
I am not aware of that.
I think that the rules differ state by state, but according to the commenters in the Serving Sarah IMDb entry, there are a lot of factual errors.
Thing that people used to say. Just if anybody asks you, are you somebody, you say, who wants to know? Never say you are the person. And never, if somebody tries to hand you paper, never accept it. And this way you will never be served.
Yeah.
But that's not really true.
No, there are a lot of silly ideas about various legal concepts that
that you can evade service somehow.
Yes. But it makes for a good movie. But not in this case.
I mainly wanted to clear this up because I actually know in at least one of our overlap communities and sort of the hacker community, there was this idea that there were ways to avoid service if you were served. Mm-hmm. And there's not.
Yeah.
At least none of these.
I don't think so. There's also, on sort of the other side of things, there used to be, I think, a lot more lax requirements about actually serving somebody and a lot of... I think this was a common practice among shady landlords a long time ago, something commonly called sewer service, where essentially you would, you know, file the complaint and then dump service in the sewer. And essentially, once it was out of your hands, you could claim that they'd been served and default judgments would be got and tenants would be evicted. I may be very much confusing the facts here, but there is definitely something called sewer service, and you can Google it and see how close I am. It'll be fun.
Or use any other search engine of your choice.
Yes, you could Bing it, for example.
Okay.
Google it on Yahoo.
Yes.
So if you served correctly the defendant and they answered, how can you still get a default judgment?
That's something that, you know...
It's the discretion of the judge, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't seem like the most appropriate motion to us to file at this stage in the litigation, given that they had answered. And so that's why we chose to make our request about summary judgment.
You guys did both, right, when you filed. You said...
Well, no. When we went in there, we went in and asked for permission to file summary judgment.
Oh,
and
the
judge said
hearing.
To us, in this conference...
Conference.
She said to us, well, you should file for both. Just file for default judgment and then the alternative summary judgment. or vice versa.
And that's what I wanted to get to. So she said to Follett in the alternative, right? Which
yes.
Which is this thing we've talked about before, where you argue one, and if that happens not to be true, you argue something else in the alternative.
Right. We like to have backup. Right. We lawyers.
So what the motion actually argues, right, is it argues for default judgment, but should that not be granted for any reason, then the alternative it argues for summary judgment, right? Is that basically how it works?
Yeah, essentially. No, that's right. We move for default judgment and then in the alternative for summary judgment. We initially went in asking for summary judgment because we thought that was more proper, but, you know, the judge gets what the judge wants. And so she told us to make a motion for default judgment, so that is...
And told us to argue in the alternative summary
judgment. It actually makes a lot of sense, and it's really nice that you were able to have that that conference, because then you had an idea of what the most expedient paperwork is. I mean, if you know how the judge wants to run the case, it saves everybody's time, right? I mean, I think that's actually quite smart.
Sure.
And so we haven't actually explained in detail what is... So we've talked about what default judgment is, win by default. What is summary judgment, and when do you get that, and what does it mean?
So the standard for summary judgment, and I think I'm just going to go ahead and read out of our...
It's good. That's one of the things that's great about reading the actual filings, is that in establishing the, basically establishing the facts of this particular case or the logic of why a particular filing is the right filing, usually in a court filing you'll see that what the standard of the test is set out in the documents themselves, and then the lawyers say why they think in this situation that test should be applied and is satisfied. So, you know, what's nice about it is that if you're reading a document, even if you don't have much background, you can see what the test is, and often because of the way that legal writing is done, they'll have basically a little explanation built into the test, and into the text of the actual filing, and sometimes it's hard to follow if you're not familiar with it, but a lot of times it clues you in.
Yes, that's true. And so here on page one of our memorandum of law supporting our motion, we give the standard for summary judgment, which is that there is no genuine issue as to any material fact regarding the issue at bar. So the issue here, we say, you know, there is copyright infringement. Here is the legal standard by which the court should decide. That there is infringement, and there we quote from the statute, the United States Code. And then we set out the facts that support that claim, and we say that there's no genuine issue of material fact. In other words, any fact that is necessary to support a claim of copyright infringement, there is no genuine issue. It's clear from what we filed. The judge can make a decision for us based on what we filed.
And then you also have to establish the facts of the copyright infringement, right? And when you're asking for a summary judgment. Because
right.
Unlike a default judgment, where you're just arguing they didn't show up, so we must be right, because
right.
No one's disputed our facts. In a summary judgment, you have to show that the preponderance of the facts show that... No?
Well, it's not a preponderance, no.
Oh, what's
it's the no genuine issue of material fact.
Okay, so there's no dispute about the key facts? Is that another way to say it, or no? Is that wrong?
Yeah, essentially, the facts necessary to support copyright infringement have been set out, and there is no genuine issue as to whether those as to those facts.
I see. So we actually had to submit various different factual documents,
yeah.
Declarations, I believe they were called.
Yeah. Right. So you submitted a declaration.
Right. I do declare.
You do declare.
Basically because I did the confirmation of the infringement,
mm-hmm.
and I had to attest to those facts.
Right. I believe Dan filed one, and also our plaintiff, Eric Anderson, filed one.
One of the plaintiffs.
One of our plaintiffs, Eric Anderson. And essentially, these are just the facts that you need to show that you have a copyright, that, you know, that the defendant copied your software, and that, I don't know why I'm saying your, the second person, and that they didn't have permission to copy the software. And so we set out the facts necessary to prove that, and the judge will then, you know, take that, and, you know, of course the case is that there's no genuine issue because the defendant hasn't responded since the initial answer.
And the facts were pretty obvious. Although I don't think that the judge's clerk is going to find that byte sequence in the safe kernel image.1.
I would love to see that. I would love to see a clerk do that. But no, I think...
I explained how in the declaration I signed. Right. I explained how to find the infringing software in the download from their website.
Yeah. So at this point now, the judge has two options. She can take a look at... take a look at our allegations, take a look at the facts that we've set out and the standard of law, and can say, okay, there is no genuine issue, and therefore I am going to find for you on summary judgment, which essentially means that the case is decided, finally in our favor on, as a matter of law. Or she can say, well, I'm going to give you default judgment because... the defendant just didn't show up. And then, there's no sort of, aside from that, the defendant not showing up, she wouldn't have to necessarily make any findings of fact or conclusions of law.
Now, I guess there's a third option that she could deny the motion, but that's less likely since there was a conference and you talked about it with her.
Yes, she seemed very sanguine about granting a motion.
It's almost like she was asking for it to be filed.
Well, it's really, it's expedient for the case, right? It
sure.
Helps for the quick handling of a legal dispute through the courts, and that's a real goal of the judges. They don't want cases to be sitting around undecided and it just, generating more paperwork.
Yes. In deciding these motions, the court is said to be balancing two interests against one another. The interest in the parties of not having undue prejudice or of the findings or the conclusion being unduly prejudicial to them, and the interest of the court in a final ruling. And, in this case, I think that the idea would be that the defendant has sort of, given over the any argument that it would be unduly prejudicial mm-hmm. to them.
By not responding and not turning up.
Unfortunately for me, I think this is a less than optimal outcome, mainly because we are, I would guess, unlikely to be able to bring them into compliance if they're sort of not there.
Sure. I mean, it's difficult when an entity, changes hands this many times and it's unclear how much is really left, It makes it more difficult to enforce a judgment.
Well, it's the thing is that the copyright statute doesn't necessarily give us compliance with GPL.
It gives us a
declaration that they're an infringement and damages. But
yeah,
what we really want is for the source code to be available for their version of BusyBox and all the other free software that's in it so that people can build firmwares for their Westinghouse TVs.
Which, absolutely.
Right. Well, it's a less than desirable outcome to even wind up in litigation.
I mean, true enough.
We try
to
avoid litigation as much as possible.
Right. Absolutely. And, of course, the result that we're looking for here is a company shipping good products in compliance with the GPL. And that's
in
always...
In the alternative.
In the alternative. in the alternative, what we see with Westinghouse. But, it's why we try as hard as we can to settle these matters before we ever have to get to the trial and making motions like this to end the dispute in our favor. But in this case, because there is essentially very little left of Westinghouse, it seems a lot less likely than with other more solvent defendants that we'll be able to.
So is there anything else in the filings that people can learn about the rules of civil procedure? It seems to me it's useful for people to understand how these things work. I would think in the U.S. in particular, most people have a relatively skewed view of how these things operate because they see things like television shows that talk about this kind of stuff, the classic lawyer show of
any kind. Yeah, I mean, I think you'll find that the filings are a lot more boring than the television shows and movies that focus on civil procedure.
Well, I sort of think it's similar to what we, most of our listeners will be familiar with what happens. You mentioned the movie Hackers, which is probably a particularly bad example, or one of the worst examples, but there's often technical terms thrown around about computing and how computers are on things like television, and yet those of us who understand computers are often surprised at the kinds of things that get said and are used as plot points when they don't make any sense. And I presume that that's quite common as well with regard to legal concepts on television and even in probably novels as well and that sort of thing.
Sure, absolutely.
There's somebody learned enough to do some damage, basically. Learned enough to use a bunch of jargon that sounds like something. And so
yeah. You'll be shocked to hear, for example, that Law and Order is not always 100% correct in its understanding of legal issues.
Serving Sarah wasn't also.
Which reminds me, I have to say, of an episode, I think, of Law and Order. I don't watch Law and Order because I think it's a terrible show, and it's been canceled. God rest its soul. But
was it actually canceled, or they decided to end it? And it's only original flavor that's gone.
Right.
No, they're crispy still on TV.
They're
Svu.
this is right after they put Jeff Goldblum on the show, right?
No, Jeff Goldblum is on Southern Style or whatever. He's on Criminal Intent.
Right. Right.
And then there's also the SUV or SV, the iced tea one. this special victims unit.
I actually didn't know that it was ending.
The main one is ending.
The main one is ending. Does that mean they'll have all the staff from previous ones come on for a final?
I doubt it.
We see Angie Herman, you know.
It's too many people.
like the last time.
And the silliest thing is they ended it before it beats the maximum running show, I believe, which is Gunsmoke. So it didn't even make the maximum number of seasons for a show ever. And they might as well. Like
Gunsmoke was the longest running show.
I think so. I think it was Gunsmoke. It was Gunsmoke. My wife looked this up.
Is The Simpsons coming up on this record?
The Simpsons is I think, two seasons behind Law & Order, as I recall. I think Law & Order started 2 to 3 years before The Simpsons.
Yeah, no, I was surprised. I thought the Law & Order was a pretty popular show,
Well, they saturated the market with the Extra Crispy and all these other flavors. And the thing is, they're launching another flavor next season.
Mm.
They've got L.A. Law & Order, so it's going to be like L.A. Law & Order. So they're sort of like a sequel to L.A. Law, but now they're going to add Order.
Wow.
Or something. Because it's some Los Angeles Law & Order show.
But
I was going to tell a story about a particular episode that I saw, because you brought up issues with technical details being glossed over in television, and though
Did
Law
Sam
& Order
Larson say people were turning a blind eye? He usually says that.
I don't think he did. But though Law & Order usually confuses issues of law, this particular show, I think two officers had broken into somebody, and maybe it wasn't even Law & Order. I don't know. I don't.
That'd be CSI, Miami.
Right.
Or...
So they were in somebody's office, and they're trying to get some information off a computer because, of course, if they can get the information in time, they can stop a crime or prevent somebody from escaping or something like that. And somebody is, of course, like, "Ah, damn, there's a password." And the other person says, "Well, usually if you try three times, they'll give you a hint." Which,
oh, I remember that.
I'm not even sure that's true of most websites these days, but certainly not of your desktop computer. And, of course, they try three times, and they give them, I think, the Japanese word for octopus or something ridiculous like that, and they're like, "Try octopus." And, so. Computers don't do that.
According to Wikipedia, there are several shows that were longer, including daytime soap operas, which, of course...
Oh, then maybe it was primetime running. Yeah, daytime soap operas obviously run for longer.
And Sesame Street.
Nice.
But that's PBS.
40 years.
It's not prime.
Well, if you keep parsing this statistic down, you can prove anything.
Yeah, it could be true. So but one of the things that I always wish Sam Morrison would do is he would say that GPL violators turned a blind eye to the free software community.
Indeed. He's not going to say that now. It's over.
Well, no. We could convince him to say it, like have a little recording.
Maybe you can just parse together clips of Sam Watterson talking and just...
I have to get him saying a G, a P, and an L by itself, which is probably possible after 20 years of Law and Order.
I don't see why not. I mean, presumably he uses acronyms.
Yeah, it's a lot of time investment.
It's well worth it.
Definitely. I thought I would just convince him as a donation to the free software community. He could record a little thing saying that.
Maybe.
Perhaps like Stephen Fry did.
Record a little. I mean, it's not unlikely that one of us could see him out in New York, right? I mean, presumably he's a local. Law and Order was always shot here, so.
That's one of the things they were saying, is that it will decrease the employment of actors in New York City.
I'll chase him around if I ever see him with my Android phone and try and get him to. My voice is my passport. Verify me.
That's Sneakers. Now, of all things, Sneakers actually was relatively accurate with regard to computing. Compared to most. It was pretty good, actually. There's not many computing mistakes or errors in that, in what they do. There's one scene where he's dialing into a lot of computers that was one of the major plot points. That's a little bit weird. Mm-hmm. Where they found that number that was the past that they got logged into everything.
He was war dialing, or
no? They found. Did anyone remember this movie? I'm gonna spoil it.
I don't even think I've seen it.
So Karen hasn't seen Sneakers and hasn't seen Tron. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What's going on there?
I haven't seen a lot of movies.
Tron is a free software movie, though. Tron is about the free software movie.
I know we were just talking about that.
Just didn't know it yet. They're trying to make it a free system again.
Yep. Trying to defeat the master control program.
Who goes around acquiring programs and won't let users have access to them.
Yep.
Think of that.
That's true.
Who is that like?
Of course, the programs are sentient and throw frisbees. But other than that, it's exactly like the free software.
So put them on the game grid.
Sounds like I'm going to have to watch it.
Yeah. I think you do. At least in preparation for Tron 2.0.
Right.
Oh, that's really horrible.
Well...
we've almost reached our decision gate. We can't spare you any more time. End of line.
All right.
That's what the master control program
says. I figured it, so I was just going with end of line.
So now we
I thought you were going to turn off the podcast there. At end
so
of
did
line.
I.
Yeah, but you all looked at me like I shouldn't have done it. But
no.
You still can, you know. We have the technology.
End of line. So I can't end the podcast because my screensaver kicked in and I didn't type my password right. But if I type it 3 times, it'll probably give me a hint.
Yeah, probably.
Thanks for joining us.
Goodbye.
The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license. Yes.
So I'm going to have to lean in this way.
I'll probably just talk like this.
I'll just sit here and lean forward.
Yeah, you're fine, bro. Lean forward.
Typical hunch posture.
We'll see what happens.
My main problem is my mumbling.
Tick, tick, tick.
I might be too far away.
I think we're fine.
End of line.